Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I'm lucky enough to be in the garden with Craig Sams and Joe Fairley, a couple who've both created several successful businesses, both on their own and together. Craig Sams' passion for healthy food started around 56 years ago, but perhaps because of his diet, he looks way younger than his 79 years. Joe, his wife, was the youngest woman editor of Look Now magazine at just 23, and then became editor of Honey. Everything in their house is organic except the Marmite, the paint, the fabrics, the clothes and the food. Craig, you've had a really busy life and it was really organic food from the get-go. Tell me how you got into that.
I got into the macrobiotic diet after travelling in the East, came back with hepatitis, and the macrobiotic diet got me straight, got me well, and I went to a macrobiotic restaurant in New York called The Paradox, and decided I was graduating from university a couple of months later, and decided I wanted to do the same thing in London. Opened a small macrobiotic restaurant. My brother joined me in the business. We opened a larger restaurant, we had a shop, and then we started wholesaling to other shops who were modeled after our shop, which was called Ceres Grain Shop. In those days, people who had health food shops used the term grain shop as a generic term to describe what we now call a natural food store.
And it's Ceres, like the god, C-E-R-E-S.
Demeter in Greek, Ceres in Latin, The goddess of grain.
And then you started up Whole Earth Foods after it was Harmony Foods first, and then it became Whole Earth Foods.
That's right.
Yeah. And then the Soil Association, that came after Green and Black. So you both started up Green and Black. Joe, tell me, how I heard a lovely story, I don't know if it's true, about you pinching a couple of squares of chocolates from Craig's desk and thinking this was the most orgasmic chocolate I've ever had, and asked him what he was going to do with it.
That's quite true, but I think it's important to say, Bunny, they were the last two squares because Craig had eaten the rest of it. And we were two squares away from history being very different, actually. I was a journalist and I never expected to have a business of my own, but I nagged Craig to the point where he said, look, if you're so interested in doing this chocolate, because I just kept going on and on saying, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? He said, well, why don't you do it? And I had to put my £20,000 equity from selling my flat before I moved in with him into buying 2 tons of chocolate. And we sat in bed one Saturday night and came up with the name Green because it was organic, and Black because it was the darkest chocolate on the market. And I whacked an ampersand in, sort of in the style of Fortnum and Mason and Charbonnel and Walker, and it just pushed all the right buttons, and I knew that we had it. And then we had to work incredibly hard to build a brand and watch it grow. But yes, it was. So it's still my favourite chocolate.
So, Craig, was your reluctance to do it and the reason you sort of pushed it over to Joe a bit because of the sugar, because you're anti the sugar and 70% chocolate, although then it was dark, wasn't it? But when we weren't really aware of the 70, 85s and 100%. But was that why you weren't so keen initially?
I was keen, but it was an additional challenge. I had got it to the point where I had found the cocoa beans because I was looking for organic peanuts. Yeah. So this was the first sort of available organic cacao for making chocolate. I got a sample made, and that's the sample that I almost consumed entirely. But there was a book by Michel Montaignac, a French author, called Dine Out and Lose Weight. And in it, he had the glycemic index of different foods. And it measures how a food affects your blood sugar levels. And brown rice, which had been the staple of my diet and the backbone of the whole macrobiotic concept, was 65 on a scale of 0 to 100. And 70% dark chocolate was only 23. So I kind of reconciled myself with my conscience and got a sample made of 70% chocolate. That's what we launched with. At the time, supermarkets said, this is cooking chocolate. People will never eat this stuff. And of course, once it was out there, and once it started selling, originally in Safeway, very soon everybody wanted it, because it was just an unexploited part of people's appetite for chocolate. Up till then, nothing was even, cooking chocolate was 49%, and here we were with the eating chocolate that was 70.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I had 100% hot chocolate this morning for my breakfast because it is the food of gods, isn't it? That's the translation of the Latin name, and it does do amazing things to you, I'm discovering. But also, I'm also very interested in the, obviously, in your garden, which you both hear. I mean, I was amazed when I looked. Well, first of all, when we stepped into your house through your brilliant pink door, front door in Hastings by the sea, we can hear the seagulls. The colours, your colour palette for all your rooms, the doors, the balusters. It's just phenomenal, isn't it? I love your choice of colours. And I do actually think of those different colour chocolate bar wrappers that are also very, well, what are they? Varied, strong, varied tones.
I always love colour. Yeah. And I think that the thing about living by the sea is that both inside and outside, you've got really strong light and you kind of need colour. So in the garden, we have a lot of strong colour in the summer, and because we can kind of get away with it.
Yeah,
I remember once going to Australia and buying a whole load of clothes, and they worked perfectly under the Australian light. And then coming back to gloomy old London, where I normally wore black and grey, and actually I just looked like a clown. I had to take them all to a charity shop. But when you've got that amazing light, as we do here, it just makes colours sing.
I cannot believe if you lived in a medieval house with little light in the middle of England that you would choose muted tones. I'm sorry. I think you'd take them with you, wouldn't you?
Probably.
Yeah. But also looking out, I like the way your garden floods into, it was the kitchen, wasn't it?
Yes.
And you see that beautiful courtyard at the lower level and the way you've got your plants there. Who is the plantsman here? Or is it both of you?
It does fall into that slightly sexist division of I'm the flowers and he's the veg.
I thought you were going to say you're the flowers, he's the design and strategy and layout.
No. Over the years, we've had a little bit of help with the design of the garden, because when we first walked into it, it was waist deep in brambles. It was an old rectory where nobody had done anything in this upper part of the garden where we're sitting now until us. It was like a sleeping beauty. And we had to take, well, Craig took a flamethrower to the knee-high, waist-high brambles, and we basically started with ground zero.
And you removed all those organically by digging them out. Were you heavily into organics,
Craig,
presumably?
Flame through them or whatever.
But that wouldn't kill a bramble.
It did.
They still
but
come
they'd come back.
Back.
They would come back. Yeah.
They come back. They still think they own the place.
Yeah.
But they
it did a jolly good job.
Now it's much easier just to cut them back when they do stick their heads up, because all the way down the garden, you just, every now and then a random bramble comes up. I think there's a mother bramble somewhere up the hill that is constantly reaching her tentacles out.
Yeah, and when you try and dig them up, of course, you're just cutting the roots, aren't you? And you're creating more brambles for you. But also the thing that I couldn't believe, I kept asking poor Craig, what was the name of that tree that must be 2-3 meters high outside your kitchen window? And you kept telling me lemon verbena or Aloysia trifolia. And I thought, he's mad, he's got the wrong plant. I've never seen one grow so huge.
No, people have commented. I don't know why. I think possibly it's in the courtyard. It gets sun all day, but it's sheltered from cold winds and all those stresses. Yeah. And we do cut it back occasionally, but it just keeps growing new branches.
No, it's phenomenal. I mean, I just think it's so, I mean, it's medically proven. I think if you look on Google Scholar, Aloysia trifolia, and there's another version of it, and it sort of gives you a feeling of well-being and it calms you down, and it's lovely after a meal, isn't it? Some hot water and lemon verbena. I think it is the best herbal drink ever.
Well, I have it usually with my second cup of tea at breakfast is a herbal tea, and it's a blend of lemon verbena and a few other plants from the garden, and you know, maybe that's what keeps me calm all day.
Yeah. Now, Joe, is he telling the truth? Is this huge businessman? Sorry, I'm treading on your toe there. Are you really calm all day?
He's
cannot
pretty
believe.
Laid back.
Really?
He's an old hippie. He's pretty laid back, Bunny.
But he's got the get-go, obviously, because of all he's done. I mean, the Soil Association, to be chairman of that, I mean, that must have been quite full on and difficult and taxing and... It's following your heart, obviously, but...
Well, we'd been involved with the Soil Association right when we started our business. And my brother sat on a committee that produced the first organic standards, which were two sides of one sheet of paper. And now it's about, I don't know, 100 and something pages. The devil is in the detail. But the Soil Association was never really interested in certifying for years. We buy from Soil Association member farmers. We'd buy wheat that we'd mill into flour and bake into bread. And but we never put the symbol on anything. I got involved as treasurer originally of the Soil Association. Charlotte Mitchell, who was the chair, sort of dragged me onto the council. And then when she stepped down, I was elected as chair and did that for 10 years. And I'm still a director of Soil Association certification, which is the certifying part of the charity.
And then, though, well, let's just a bit more about Joe, because one of the other things that you've done, so you're obviously into sustainability as well, but you've also started the Perfume Society and the Beauty Bible.
Well, Beauty Bible started in 1996 as a series of books with my co-author, Sarah Stacey, to kind of help women take a shortcut to things that really worked. And we had this unique idea of sending actual products to real women and getting them to feed back in a very kind of organised, formalised way.
So if I wanted to look up what mascara that was good,
then you'd go straight to beautybible.com, because we've now done that for, many, many books, and then subsequently since 2001 online. And we're the only people in the world that we don't take advertising, which is probably mad. But we, nobody can buy their way into our books or onto our website. And everything is independently tested. And it was partly born out of, I'd become a beauty editor by accident. I'd been a journalist. I'd had an eco column in the Times. I'd edited magazines. I'd written about sumo wrestling. The most varied career. And then the minute I started to write about anything to do with beauty, that's all editors wanted me to do, because I brought a kind of outsider's perspective to it. And with the Beauty Bible, our USP was always just to help women not waste product, not waste money on things that didn't work, and to find stuff that actually delivered on its promises. So there's a little bit of an eco thing with that. And then the Perfume Society is just simply because I'm obsessed with smell. Absolutely obsessed with it. And I don't run it anymore. I sold it to my business partner, but I do edit a magazine called The Scented Letter, which you can find via perfumesociety.org, which is the only magazine about perfume in the world. Extraordinarily.
Wow. Wow. I have to say, I love natural perfumes. Mm. But my mother always used to get in the car at the weekend when we were going somewhere, and we had to dress up in dresses and ghastly things like that. And she'd be coated in perfume and powder, and I'd be sitting in the back seat throwing up.
Well, I'm sorry you've got bad memories, but there are billions of women that do love it, Bunny.
I'm the odd one out, but I just always, that has just impinged on my mind, and I associate perfumes with getting dressed up and throwing up.
Well, equally, isn't it? I love scented plants, and I've tried to squeeze as many as possible into the garden.
Yeah, I can see quite a few around here. I loved your camellias, of course, but they're not very scented, are they?
Alas, it's the only thing wrong with the camellia.
Yes, sadly.
It brings you colour and life in February when everything else is sulking. But the man that brings out a scented camellia is really going to make a fortune.
Well, maybe that's you, Craig. Maybe that's your next project. But
I think we should grow camellias that you can use the leaves for tea.
People do grow them in Devon and Cornwall and in wall gardens in Scotland.
That's Camellia sinensis. Yes. I don't know if the flowery ones, can you use their leaves?
Oh, I see. Well, I don't know. That would, no. You could try. I'm sure it's not toxic. I'll check it out on Google Scholar.
Okay, let us know. I'm reluctant to try it until somebody else has done the guinea pig work.
And you're also, Joe, obviously known for, because you're a great mate of Paula Yates.
Yep.
And sadly, you tragically discovered her when she'd overdosed.
I did, sadly. Worst day of my life.
Ah, must have been awful. And then your adopted daughter was a great friend of Peach's.
Yes. So there's been a lot of tragedy. But, as I always say, I think that the dark times show you your strengths, and life is about light and shade. You know, you can't live your life as Pollyanna and just expect every day to be, you know, sunshine and rainbows and butterflies. It's the contrast that actually makes you feel alive.
Yes. But she was obviously well known for being really out there, her clothes, her makeup. Did that rub off on you? Did she give you, you know, dress lessons and makeup and things like that? Or
God, she... No.
Maybe it worked the other way.
Very different, but we loved doing the same things. And there was nothing that we liked more than, you know, mooching around looking for vintage fabrics, many of which you can see in my house. Having a cup of tea on a comfy sofa, flowers. You know, there are a lot of those things, the kind of, you know, small pleasures of life were what we had in common. But I was never as outrageous as her. But we were a perfect complement to each other. It's that thing of opposites attracting, I think.
Yes. I mean, I never met her, but I did help Bob with his garden. And they were obviously quite opposite, weren't they, as well, Bob and Paula?
Yeah.
Really. But no, it was really sad.
Well, Paula wrote a very loving portrait of Joe in her book, The Village People, that captured some of Joe's more endearing characteristics. And, you know, they were a match made in heaven from that point of view.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Really nice. And did you agree with how she captured you? Or were you flattered?
Oh, it was very funny. I mean, she was the funniest person I knew. And very sadly, I mean, she'd just bought a house in Hastings just before she died, because this was a place that she absolutely loved coming to visit us and totally got it. And ironically, we found this house. We saw that for sale sign to this house was, we'd just been put up on the day before the funeral. We'd come down to go to her funeral. And I ended up making an offer on the house in the car on the way to the funeral, going, it's what she would have wanted. And actually having this house and this garden to focus on in the months after she died was a complete lifesaver. Mm. You know, there's nothing like waist-high brambles to tackle and, you know, redecorating an old house to take your mind off things. And it was very healing.
Obviously, you're both have lots and lots of time pressures on you with your businesses and things like that. So does the garden help you? Do you use that? I mean, it's full of beautiful specimens. I'm standing under an olive tree.
There's a wonderful story. No, there's a wonderful story. This is the story of Craig's and my relationship, this olive tree, so, which is now about, what do you reckon, Bunny, 25 foot tall?
I would think so. The circumference of the trunk, I would say, is something like 60, 70 centimetres.
Yeah. So basically,
big. Yeah.
Craig and I had been friends for some time. And
this was age, what were you?
Mere Stripling. The sort of end of the 80s.
Yeah.
So we'd been friends and we had a lovely mutual friend who we would go and visit on a Saturday in hospital. She'd sadly had a stroke and we would kind of chat over her bed. And one day another friend came who had just started importing olive trees to the UK. And you have to remember, in the late 80s, olives weren't a thing in the UK. They were absolutely unknown. And I remember Craig saying that he would love an olive tree. And very endearingly, he used to sort of occasionally put his hand on my knee on the way back to when I was driving him home and sort of, you know, and I rebuffed his passes.
Quick smack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and then my lovely agent came over from New York and we were walking down Portobello Road where Craig lived and I took her in to see Craig. And when we came out, she said, "Joe, if you don't even consider this guy, I'm never speaking to you again."
How much had you slipped her, Craig, to say that?
And I said to Kay, "Well, you know, he's just a friend, you know." And I said, "But okay, look, he's coming to tea on Monday. I'll have a look at him in the cold light of day. And just think, okay, if he wasn't a friend, what would I think?" So anyway, I opened the door to him on Monday and it was like, "Oh my God, you're gorgeous." So then it was like, well, how do I make my overture to say it's all okay? And I had the idea of buying an olive tree and delivering it to him. And weirdly, in New York, in Hallmark, years before, I'd bought a card which I'd just had in a folder of cards, and it said, "What do you do when an attractive health food salesman comes knocking on your door?" And it said, "Go ahead and vitamin." And it was the corniest joke ever. And I attached it to this olive tree and sent it over. And the rest, as they say, is history. And then when we moved here from our roof deck in London, where Olivier, as we call him, lived in a pot, we planted him by the wall of this walled garden. And he's now vast. I mean, yeah, we've lived here for 23 years. And, you know, we frequently have to have this terrace relaid because he's pushing up
heaving up the
stones.
Pages.
And he's the living embodiment of our love.
Oh, that is a nice story. He's probably 4 metres high, Olivier, or her, and probably 5 metres across, I would say, would you? Yeah, easily, from the edge of the canopy.
Well, and he drops down over the garden wall on the other side. There's a lot more. In fact, we should really tidy up all the leaves that fell off over the last couple of months.
Oh, I think they look rather nice.
No, the ones outside, I'm saying.
They're on the
footpath, and they shouldn't be anyway.
But the other tree, of course, when you come into your garden, I mean, this is a lovely walled garden on a slope, and the slope faces
southeast.
So it would be, it's so productive then, isn't it? And the massive tree in the sort of centre of the garden is a mulberry, which, how old do you reckon that is, with many stems and fallen limbs?
It's probably, it has a history. David Garrick, you may have heard of the Garrick Club, was the first Shakespearean actor who really, what you might nowadays call a lovey, he really put his heart and soul into the part. And there was a chap here called Edward Capel who went through all of the various folios of Shakespeare's work that were kicking around and produced the collected works of William Shakespeare that we all know and love. And David Garrick would visit him regularly to keep up with his progress. Garrick lived over in Hampshire, so he wasn't that far away. And Garrick had a tree that was a cutting from the mulberry tree that had been in Shakespeare's garden in Stratford-on-Avon. And he gave a small tree to Capel, who lived just down by the seafront. A couple of mulberry trees in Hastings were cuttings from Capel's tree. So this mulberry that you see has been here for a few hundred years. We have to cut it back or it would take over the whole garden, because mulberries can be quite aggressive. You know, they drop a branch down. They're a bit like brambles, but on a larger scale.
And then they layer from it,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah. Just like brambles do.
Bob had a lovely one, Bob Geldof, in his garden, exactly like that, didn't he? Which just dropped limbs and layered. And that gives them an amazing character, doesn't it, I think? Yeah.
So this one goes back to Shakespeare's garden in Stratford-on-Avon. I always think mulberries are called mulberries, like muleberry, because you can't plant a mulberry and get a plant. They don't grow because they don't have a seed inside the berry.
So you have to propagate it vegetatively. Yeah. And they are quite difficult, aren't they? So the white mulberry is very easy from a cutting, but those are really quite difficult. The fruiting ones, is it? They're Morris Nigra, the black. But you can layer them, as you say, can't you? I think that is the easiest way to layer them. But apart from this garden here, you did buy, didn't you, 27 acres on the outside of Hastings and planted, was it 20 acres of chestnut coppers and also a fruiting hedge and things. Who was the one behind this? This massive...
We inherited the coppice. That was already there. And it's got about 13 standing oaks, huge oaks.
Oh, so it's...
We planted an orchard.
Yes.
And we planted a hedge with a lot of fruiting plants in it. So there are a lot of fruit trees that we've planted, including something called a saltcut pippin, which we have sort of almost rescued from oblivion. It was a wood that we had always loved, and one day I was kind of just online on a Sunday, I don't know, looking at a property auction site or something, and it was coming up for auction, and we were lucky enough to get it, and it's just the most, you know, amazing thing to care for a woodland and plant an orchard. It's one of the great joys of our life.
And you do actually actively work the coppice, do you? Sort of cut it every 12 years?
Technically, but yes, it's a bit overstood at the moment. And the challenge is always getting machinery in. But there is someone who has shire horses, which I love the sound of a shire horse in the orchard, because getting, you know, a tractor in there is hard.
And your hedge has some things like the Polish variety of elderberry, which produces really quite big fruit, doesn't it? The Polish variety of the elderberry you've got.
I can't remember the list of plants, but I do know that there are dog roses, and there's berberis, and there is viburnum, and
damsons,
bullaces, and damsons, and yes, lots.
Cherry plums. There are a lot of different fruit. We tried to have as fruity a hedgerow as we could get away with. And the there are crab apples, obviously. We don't have, the medlars are outside, though. Yeah, that's in the actual orchard.
Is it quite difficult to manage, or was it in the early stages? Because you obviously leave the flowers and fruit on quite late to get the crop. And then you cut them back afterwards, or did it look like a conventional hedge, or was it just like a lovely big hedgerow?
It's a lovely big hedgerow, and it needs laying again. I mean, that's the thing about hedges, is they grow. It's nature will take over the world if you let it.
Good thing too, I reckon. that sounded really interesting. It's just I remember that Raymond Blanc was doing lots of fruiting hedgerows, and at Time Hotel in Oxford, which we've been working on, they've done the same. It's quite a popular concept, and I think you can do it in a small private space, can't you? You can produce lots of unusual fruits in a small space that's quite productive, because not many people want, you know, acres of cherries or whatever, do they? There's only so many you can pick and use at a time.
And I think that the thing about growing anything yourself is that what you really want to grow are the things that you can't buy in the shops.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can't buy any of those things. You can't buy mulberries. And when it comes to growing veg and salads and herbs for the home, it tends to be things that you can't just, you know, go down to Tesco and buy or even get from Ocado. And so that shapes our choice of growing things.
And what have you got in your raised bed here? So you've got a nice brick raised bed, I think. And what have you got in that?
Well, we have, it's seasonal. The established things are the herbs. So there's always parsley, thyme, oregano, and lemon balm. We have a protected dandelion reserve. So it's about 15 dandelion plants that are, because the pigeons will eat dandelions. We never anticipated that, but they ravaged the dandelions until we put up a chicken cage over them.
And do you blanch them, or do you just use the leaves as they are?
Craig eats them as salad. And
yeah, they're good.
That's one of those, yeah. You know, in every marriage, there are things in the garden that you disagree about. And dandelions are the thing that drive me mad. Because obviously he doesn't manage to pick every one before it goes to seed. And so there is a bit of a dandelion problem elsewhere in the garden. But Craig is half Syrian, or his father was Syrian ancestry, and dandelions are a key part of the Syrian diet. So that's why dandelions are an important part of our diet, or rather Craig's diet.
But they are, the French call them pissenlit, don't they? Because they're a diuretic, make you pee.
They are a diuretic,
but they are,
yeah,
an antioxidant, and they've got all the usual things. And if you blanch them by putting a plate over, they don't have quite such a bitter taste.
We don't blanch them. I had an uncle, Murray Tony, who lived to be 111. When he was 105, I went with his daughter-in-law to interview him, and he'd had a cataract operation the year before. And I said, it must have been great to see your family again, to be able to see your grandkids and all of that. And he said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And another great thing was nobody else would pick dandelions for me. And once I got my eyesight back, I could have dandelion salad on a regular basis. And I've always thought, well, if he died at 111, six years after that interview, and I just thought, well, maybe dandelions have something to do with it. Anyway.
I think if you saw them in a bag in Waitrose, to be honest, and they'd be pre-washed and everything, I think people would pay, you know, like for coriander, or at least, wouldn't they? And there are some variety, an ornamental variety, aren't there, with a purple leaf, I think, but they do seed. I remember working in Japan, the bane of the gardeners there was the English dandelion, because our dandelion had got there, and they couldn't control it. Whereas a Japanese dandelion was fine, but it just seeded so prolifically out there that it was a real pain. But what else? What other things do you do? Because you do unusual things with your veg. I mean, someone told me that you grew lots of angelica.
We don't. It's not actually angelica. It's something that grows. It's called Alexander's.
Oh, Alexander's. Oh,
and
right.
It's...
Yeah. They're good, yeah.
It was known as Alexandrian parsley. The Romans brought it.
Yep, I have it.
And it naturalized in the warmer parts, coastal region. So you get it in Cornwall and Devon, and you get it here, and it comes up, it starts coming up in late December, and it's still just getting to flowering now.
And we are now mid-Feb, aren't we?
Mid-Feb.
Just before Valentine's Day. Yeah.
And it'll be edible right through now till the end of March.
But you lift the root, someone said, and shredded the root and marinated in alcohol, or have I got that wrong? Because we grow Alexanders too. It grows with me up near Stamford. So it's harder than people think. I did get some seed or something from somewhere, and because it's such a beautiful early flower, isn't it? And the chickens like the leaves. And every part of the plant is edible. It's one of those, you know, you cannot lose.
I don't think he's actually dug up the root and eaten it. But we do eat the stems, and we do eat the stems of cardoons as well, which we grow in the garden.
And you blanch the cardoon stems?
No, we don't blanch them, but if you get them young enough, they're tender.
And then you just sort of braise them?
Yeah, and have them with a bit of lemon juice or something.
Oh, right. And so you'll get the young stems in sort of June or something, would you?
Probably a bit earlier than that.
A bit earlier, yeah. I suppose you're south of me. Yeah, I keep intending to blanch them, like they say in the books, the cardoon, but I'll try without it. Like
ours grow on a slope, so trying to find something that will blanch them on a slope might be challenging.
You blanch them with boiling water, don't you?
No, that's a different sort of blanch.
Oh, you blanch them by covering them. Oh, I see, yeah.
And then it makes the stems much more tender, bleached of chlorophyll, and a slightly more subtle taste, like with sea kale. Do you grow sea kale?
We tried. What happened? Why didn't that work?
It's a funny one. You buy thongs, don't you? Those funny little roots. I remember my mum grew loads of it on her nursery, and when they opened the Channel Tunnel, she supplied it to the French chefs were doing the dish, and so she gave them loads of sea kale to cook. But it's one of those things that sounds romantic and lovely, and I think it looks beautiful in the garden, but I don't think it tastes very strong, although you have to give it with a nice buttery sauce to give it some oomph, otherwise you would just think it was sort of limp cabbage.
But what we do get in the spring, the sea kale that grows along the seafront.
Yes, cranberry.
Produces, no, it's sea
kale. The flowers, cranberry.
Yeah, they produce
its name.
Flowers.
Yeah.
That are just like broccoli.
Yeah, I picked those
and
as well.
That's a lovely, yeah, short season, but a lovely vegetable to have when it's.
Yeah, I
full
usually
flow.
Pick the young shoots when they're blanched and boiled and cook them with a bit of sauce, and then I have the flowers when it goes up to flower. And they are lovely, actually. Even raw, I think they're tasty, aren't they?
Yeah.
So your garden here is, as I said, stunning. There's so many sort of big euphorbias. What is the most tender thing that you grow here that you hadn't expected to grow, do you think? I can see agapanthus, just everything, isn't it?
I think it's the lemon verbena that really blows people away. But we do, I mean, I just take it for granted that things grow here. And then people like you come along and go, gosh, I'm amazed that you can get that through the winter. But honestly, in the whole time that we've lived here, we've only had a couple of really bad frosts, and only
when you say really bad, you're going to say -2 degrees centigrade,
two
or something,
maybe five possibly, on a really bad
for a fleeting
day.
nanosecond,
you know, the sea is a wonderful radiator.
And
so
we got loquat fruit
last year. That
did
was amazing.
Because mine never fruits. I've got the tree.
It was extraordinary. I came out here one day in the previous November, and I'm like, what's that smell? And it was the most beautiful, exotic white floral scent, honeyed.
Yes.
And that whole tree was covered in bumblebees.
Wow.
And sure enough, they turned into fruit, and we had fruit last summer. And that was after that incredibly hot summer 2 years ago. So I don't know if we'll get that. I didn't see any blossom on it in November. But I think it's got to size now that if we have an amazing hot summer, it will fruit again.
And did you get many fruit?
Yes, but probably not quite as many as the birds.
And what did you do with them? You just
ate them off the tree.
And they were delicious.
Yeah. Well, we have a long standing connection with Ibiza and Formentera, and that's what inspired us to try a loquat. In Ibiza and Formentera, they ripen, they produce fruit, obviously, every year.
Yeah.
And you just eat them.
So up where I'm near Stamford, obviously, East Midlands, we get down to -17, perhaps, but not a lot, you know. But my loquat tree grows brilliantly. I think it's totally hardy. And it actually, I planted it too close to the house, so I cut it down the other year, and it zoomed back up. I cut it right to the ground, and it's back up again, like, you're not getting rid of me. But they are beautiful in their own right, even if they don't get the fruit, aren't they? I think they're lovely, evergreen, good shape, nice, lovely. Big leaves, yeah. Big, bold, architectural leaves, yeah.
I do wish you hadn't said that about cutting it back, Bunny, because the other argument that we always have is about pruning. Yes. And so if Craig now knows that he can cut it back and it'll come back, he'll be out there with his chainsaw or his saw or whatever.
Oh, you're a hack and slasher, Craig. I thought you were sort of organic, gentle.
I am a normal. I am totally normal about pruning. But, you know, for Joe, any pruning, however minor, is like amputation.
Yeah.
And
it's such a common theme on Gardener's Question Time. You know, the woman asks the question, can I cut this? And the man, my husband wants to, but I love it. I mean, it's always the way. The woman wants it and the man likes to. I think they like doing physical stuff and keeping things under control. I've been really sexist here. Sorry, Craig.
I think, yeah, that is quite sexist. Yeah. But it's, you know, and you could just say, well, some people are better at gardening than others. You know, and some people are better at decorating living rooms.
Yes. So obviously gardening is one of your big things because of the biochar. Now, this company you started up, what, sort of 10 years ago or so?
14 years ago. Yeah.
And you were the first, when I first encountered biochar, it was via Carbon Gold. It was your baby. I don't think there were any on the market in the UK before that.
No, we also launched our first compost, and it was completely peat-free because biochar, if you add it to your compost, compensates for the carbon compounds that you get in peat that make peat so effective. So we went out marketing our Carbon Gold biochar compost as peatless peat. And people said, why? What's wrong with peat? Why do you want to be peatless? And of course, that was then. Now everybody gets it about peat.
Well, and it's still under discussion, but we won't have that debate now.
Yeah, but it's the debate. At least there is a debate. There was no debate. People said, what's wrong with peat? And we struggled along despite that.
So have you used lots of biochar on your garden here, veg?
Well, it's everywhere now in our garden. It's in the veg plot. It's around most of the fruit trees.
So we put it on the top of the fruit trees?
Yeah. We actually, with the mulberry tree, we had something. There's a device called a geo-injector, a company called Apex Soil Solutions.
It's a bit like an all-terrain aerator that has probes that blast it into the ground.
It blasted, 18 inches, 2 feet down into the ground, and about a meter in every direction.
And blast air and sometimes something else.
So like the air is the, it blasts the biochar in. And we enrich the biochar with mycorrhizae and trichoderma so that you get the biology as well. And then when it's in the ground, your soil microbiome comes to life really quickly.
Mm.
We'd had a spot on the leaf of the mulberry towards the end of the summer. It was really getting very kind of spotty. And I think it's a bacterial disease, which doesn't kill the tree, but doesn't look very nice. And obviously we wanted to keep the mulberry as healthy as possible. And that was really, for me, the second example with my very own eyes, being a little bit more cynical, you know, about my husband's business than he is, of it working. Because last year we had much less spot. Last year we didn't have any spot. So I really think it helped the health of the trees. And in fact, I mean, I think it cured the Queen's honey fungus at one point. But it's used at Buckingham Palace. But also, I was incredibly cynical when he first launched it. It was partly because all of Craig's experiments with biochar were done in our Magimix, and so my house was covered in a fine film of black soot for quite a long time. So I was a bit anti. So I needed to see with my own eyes that it worked. So I planted some Nicotiana, and I planted two patches, one with and one without. And the ones with were a foot taller, much stronger, and they flowered sooner. And so it's like, okay, I guess this stuff works.
Should we go back and just explain to anyone who's listening who hasn't come across biochar, carbon gold? So carbon gold's your brand name. Biochar is a substance. And can you... It's not identical to charcoal. It's slightly different, and it's a different particle size. Can you just explain, Craig, how you make it?
Well, it's made in various ways, but basically you cook wood.
Yes.
And you don't let oxygen in. So it's how you make charcoal.
Yeah.
You keep the oxygen out, and so instead of burning, the carbon in the wood becomes isolated. Everything else goes up, but the carbon stays there. You can then press that into charcoal briquettes and cook your sausages or whatever. Or when you add it to the soil, when it's in the soil, it provides what's called a refugia. It's a safe space for the beneficial fungi and bacteria that make for healthy soil. Normally in soil, you've got various lions and tigers, if you like, the predators in the soil, like, there are nematodes, there are mites, there are even amoebae will eat the beneficial microbes in the soil. When you have biochar in the soil, the beneficial microbes shelter in the biochar. They become like hundreds of tiny little fortresses for them. And so that population of the beneficial fungi and bacteria expands, and that's to huge benefit to the plants that share with them, because the plants are living in harmony with them, and the parasites or the predators that would normally eat those beneficial bacteria in the microbiome can't get at them. So you have healthy, resilient soil, and that means that the plants are also healthy and resilient.
I mean, I was talking to Professor Lynn Boddy. I don't know if you know, come across her, who's a mycologist.
Yeah.
I think we're now beginning to realise the importance of the whole mycorrhiza and the soil, the whole microbiome of the soil. Just like our guts, it's funny, isn't it? It's like in tandem. And when you talked about your diet of unleavened bread and low sugar, which is helping your gut microbe, similarly, lots of any leaf mold, mulches, charcoal, are so beneficial to the soil.
If you travel in India,
yes,
and you get Delhi belly, as they call it, charcoal tablets are the cure. You take the charcoal and your gut microbiome becomes happier and healthier. And for some reason, the bad guys can't compete with the ones that are beneficial to you.
I had that problem in France, and I was about six, and they took me to a French doctor, and he said, beaucoup de gas, lots of gas, wind, and gave me loads of charcoal. Yes, not so pleasant to eat, but it did the job. But and your biochar is ground to a certain size to maximize the amount of organisms.
Absolutely. We keep it. We don't have any particles that are more than 6 millimeters, and most of them are smaller than that. And that means you get a nice, good distribution in the soil, and it stays there.
So if you've got an existing raised bed and you're doing no dig, would you just put it on the top, or what? Or would you put it in the hole as you plant your little lettuce plant?
Well, the worms will bring it down. Whatever, you can put it on the top if you don't want to disturb the soil.
Yeah.
If you can get it in, all the better. Once it's there, it just becomes part of the microbiome. And I just saw the word the other day, but you mentioned Lynn Boddy. Mycobiome is the fungal network as well. So you've got a microbiome and a mycobiome working together to keep your plant happy and healthy.
And also the worms, the faunal, you know, the worm. I just looked on Google Scholar to see if I could find evidence of it. And they were saying that it just definitely does increase the worm population in the soil on trials they've done. Have you done experiments on it yourself? Or have you got Reading or someone to do it for you or with you?
What, trials on worm?
No, on biochar generally, using it on crop production, apart from your lovely example. Because I can imagine, like in Japan, they used a lot of effective microorganisms a few years ago. I think they still do. And where they had poor soil, it really changed. It really improved yields. But where they had a really good, rich soil, it didn't make so much difference, which you can understand in a way. I mean, would that be the same with you?
The Q have used our product to save a chestnut avenue that went from the Queen Anne's cottage all the way along.
They injected it, did they?
Yeah, they injected it.
Yeah.
Isle of Wight salads have used it to grow tomatoes and lettuces.
Yes.
It works very well in greenhouse conditions. The flaw, if you like, in my business model is that once you've added biochar to the soil, you don't really have to add it again.
Mm.
So, I suppose there is a limit, but we're nowhere near it. You know, there's a few billion acres on the planet that still need biochar. So.
And when you make it, the energy comes off, presumably, which is utilized, is it, when you're making your charcoal?
When it's made, you get some gases, what are called off gases.
Yeah.
There are two ways to deal with it. If you're out in the field, you can recycle them, and they drive the process. So they act as an extra heat source, if you like.
Right.
They act as a flame. In other situations, like a sawmill, it's used to generate electricity. So you're making the biochar, you're getting all the carbon out of the wood, but you're also generating electricity that helps to drive the process.
Yeah, interesting. And I saw somewhere that they're using it in hydroponics, which I really did not understand. Is that right?
Yeah, because again, in hydroponics, the more biology you can get, the more you can get the benefit of the biology, the better.
But how can you get biology in water? You know, that water with a feed.
Well, because you've got the biochar in the water, holding the microbial life that would otherwise life. Yeah, well, it's there, yeah, and it doesn't wash away.
I see.
And so you get all that benefit that otherwise you would lose.
Right, I understand it now, because I always think of hydroponically grown food, you know, fast food. I always think, has it got anything in it at all? Is it really? Often doesn't taste of much.
Well, most hydroponic production doesn't waste the water. It sort of recycles it quite a bit. So you still get that benefit, but the biochar just stays there.
Right, I see. No, interesting. So, your current diet, both of you, your food is, you're into beauty products and everything like that. So, what do you put down to your wonderful way you look so amazing at your age and lifestyle and health?
We do only eat what we can get organically, mostly. I think there are a couple of exceptions. Marmite, as you said. Boursin, which is my sort of guilty cheese pleasure, which I rediscovered after many, many years, which goes back to childhood. But pretty much everything else we get is organic.
Mm.
And I remember back in the early 90s when we were living together, and that meant a very limited diet, Bunny. But now there's almost nothing. Actually, crumpets. Briefly, you could get organic crumpets, but you can't now. So those are another non-organic thing that snuck into our diet.
I thought Warburton's did organic crumpets.
Oh, maybe they do. I need to look a bit harder.
I'll email Jonathan Warburton. He gave me some last time. I helped him with his garden, and he gave me a pack and put them on top of the car. And I didn't realise. And I drove off with the crumpets flying. So I missed them, sadly. I live to regret it to this day.
But we do eat a lot of whole grains and pulses. Brown rice is probably the peak of what we eat. We eat more of that than anything else. We even have pasta made with brown rice is really superb.
Really? Pasta with brown rice?
It comes from La Viala, a biodynamic farm in Italy. And they produce this Italian spaghetti, linguine, fettuccine, all with brown rice. And it's so for people who have gluten problems, obviously it makes a big difference, but it's just delicious pasta.
Oh, that is well worth knowing. And rice is one of the things they say, if you're not going to do much organic, you definitely should do rice because of what they use in the paddy fields.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, that's interesting. What is your top beauty secret, please?
From my top beauty secret.
Well, actually, tell me how to look 10 years younger. It's apart from wear a mask. You know, balaclava.
One of the things people don't do is they buy products. I mean, so somebody will buy a product that they've read about on Beauty Bible and then they will chop and change. And after a couple of weeks go, oh, I want the next best thing and the next good thing and I'm going to try a bit of that, etc. But the reason we've had incredibly high scores for a lot of products that you would call kind of miracle treatments and which their manufacturers would call miracle treatments, and half the population is extremely cynical about this. They go, nothing really makes a difference. But actually, the reason we get such great scores is because women use them consistently, because they're filling in these forms over a period of months. So they're sticking with it. And more than that, we actually ask them to start off by using it on half their face. And so they can see with their very own eyes and report back on the difference. So it's consistency, which is a huge thing, and sun protection. I mean, you know, on my face, I use SPF. I actually use olive oil on my body, which is a bit sacrilegious, but I'm allergic to every single kind of SPF on my body, and olive oil does the job. I don't burn.
Does that have a UV protector, olive oil?
It's highly antioxidant, yes.
There's but it would actually
industry
stop you
that
burning.
Doesn't want me to say this, but and I you know, I wouldn't use it on a child, and I wouldn't use it if I had incredibly pale, freckly skin, but it's fine on me.
Right. One thing I've been trying, I'm a bit of a fan of neem oil. Do you know neem oil from India? And I looked up on Google Scholar and they said if it's actually does boost your collagen levels in your skin. And so I've been, started off, I diluted it with almond oil and then I just slap it on neat. And I find that's got a rather funny smell.
It's got a strange smell, Bunny.
Soon goes. Or do I still smell now?
It's also quite antifungal, I think, as well.
Yeah, so
very
do you think
good
that
for,
would be bad for your the microorganisms on your face?
I mean, I've never thought of using it on my face. I might have to have a go. I usually use it on my feet and cuticles.
Oh, now why do you use it on your feet? Or shouldn't I ask?
It's the antifungal thing. Oh, it's good for feet. It's very good. Right. They use it in India in Ayurvedic medicine. They use it on feet, I believe.
I just remember in Japan, they use it. The people I work for there, they use it in their greenhouses. They sprayed it on their plants.
Yes.
And it killed all manner of insects organically. And it's used in Germany and many countries. But as usual, in the UK, I think it's sort of not legally cleared, is it? So if you're using it, it's possibly illegal.
Can't be sold, but doesn't mean you can't have a go in your own backyard.
Yeah, they're very funny about this, aren't they? That sort of thing. But I thought, anyway, I quite like neem oil. But I will try your olive oil for sure. So I bought your present. I always bring the people I talk to a present. And I bought you Iris Reticulata Harmony.
Oh.
And I just thought Harmony, because of Craig's business, made perfect sense. And I got it from my local garden centre, Well and Vale Garden Centres in Uppingham. And they always have a lovely array of plants. But I just thought it's such a beautiful little iris at this time of year.
Absolutely beautiful.
To have on your table or anything.
Yes, I mean, you know, we're all just seeing those shoots come up and flowers start to open, and it just feels like the world is opening up again. It's a wonderful feeling.
It is, isn't it? And it's only mid-February. I just think, are we going to have snow and things to come? Or you won't, but we might well. But anyway, it's been fantastic to chat to you. Thank you both very much indeed. That's really kind. Can you give me a tip, though, before I go? The best gardening tip from one of you that you know that other people might not have heard of?
I think Craig once, he said after lockdown, because our garden definitely looked better after lockdown than any previous year. Didn't you say something about the best tool is the gardener's shadow? You've got to be, you know, you've got to be in the garden.
Absolutely.
And then you will see the results. I mean, you know, I do have to give a bit of credit to the two lovely people who help us with this garden, because it is too much for two human beings. So we have a wonderful plants woman called Lizzie Maynard, who used to work at Sissinghurst, and Sarah Raven. So yeah, she's very good at the fiddly stuff. And then we have a lovely Polish lady called Christina, who can haul out a tree when I need her to. So, you know, it's yes.
So the shadow of the gardener is the best fertilizer. It's a Chinese proverb, isn't it? And I think it's just keeping your eye on everything. It's
keeping your eye.
I've just put a load of cuttings in the greenhouse, and I know if I don't go and watch them every day for the first few days, I want to catch them before they start to wilt, yep, and spray them. And if a weed's coming up before it gets a pain, I think that is the best bit of gardening advice to anyone. Actually, you can't binge it and then leave it for 2 weeks.
No,
just even if you just trot round quickly and just keep your eye on things.
So I've stolen Craig's tip.
Oh, Craig, give us a tip then for the best.
That was my tip, but there you are. No, I think sometimes the opposite is true. That sometimes you just have to see where a plant is going and what it's doing, and not be too quick to jump in and try and direct its growth, because particularly with vegetables, you know, you can harvest too soon, and you can leave things too late. But generally, I think we keep our table well fed. We have omelets once a week that have parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, to quote the Simon and Garfunkel. and that, you know, we eat our garden. There's almost everything that we can eat from the garden, we do eat. And I think that's the benefit that you can't measure, is how healthy it is to eat stuff that you've harvested yourself and grown yourself.
It's fresh, it's varied, different things. Yeah.
Even in our roof garden in Portobello, where the olive tree first lived, we had these raised beds where we grew vegetables, and it was really, really unusual at that time to have kind of a London veg garden in raised beds like that. And I was astonished how much food we could grow in a couple of raised beds. I mean, waist-high troughs. We'd never had to buy a salad veg all summer long.
Yeah. No, it is amazing. I remember Seymour, you know, the organic grower, did an experiment. He reckoned in, was it 9 or 12 square feet you could feed a man, keep a man in veg all year. Now, I think he was better than me. He obviously really had his rotations worked and everything, and did it really intensively. But it's telling, isn't it, just what you can get out of a few square meters of soil, especially if you use carbon gold. Anyway.
Thank you for that.
Thank you both very much. That's really nice. And I love your garden.
Thank you, Bunny.
Thanks, Bunny.